It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, there's been a lot of debate over free trade agreements in the presidential race. Our guest talks about the impact those kinds of agreements have on Wisconsin.
First, the Democratic National Convention kicked off last night, and like the GOP convention last week, one of the big topics of conversation has been party unity.
With the Republicans, it was about convincing party delegates to rally behind Donald Trump, who is a dark horse at the beginning of the campaign, but who rallied major support nationwide. He officially received the party's nomination last week.
And among the Democrats, while Hillary Clinton was widely seen as a shoo-in for the nomination at the beginning of the campaign, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders garnered a groundswell of support and still has the support of many voters.
Now Sanders is calling on his supporters to coalesce behind Clinton, but many are still feeling burned by the party's handling of the campaign and hacked emails released on the eve of the convention.
Joining us now to talk about where the party stands now is Claire Foran. She's an associate editor at The Atlantic and has been covering the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia as part of The Atlantic's politics and policy team. Claire, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
The theme of this convention is supposed to be unity. And Claire, does what you've seen so far look like unity to you, or even the beginning of unity?
Well, I think the convention is certainly got off to a rocky start last night. If you are sort of thinking conventions are kind of designed to be sort of these choreographed, stage-managed shows of unity, but instead what we saw last night was Bernie Sanders supporters were actually booing a lot of the speakers at the convention. At one point, it wasn't consistent throughout the entire evening, but a lot of it was sort of booing anytime Hillary Clinton's name was mentioned for various points during the evening. And there was even boos when Sanders himself spoke and basically, you know, was making the case for Hillary Clinton. So it was certainly very tense and also in some ways kind of an embarrassing spectacle for party leaders who wanted to put up a show of unity.
So Clinton now obviously has the delegates to claim the nomination. It seems as though that some of Bernie Sanders' diehard supporters still seem to be hoping for a different scenario, a different outcome. And Bernie Sanders spoke, as you said, last night. Here's a clip.
We need leadership which brings our people together and makes us stronger. Not leadership which insults Latinos and Mexicans, insults Muslims and women, African Americans and veterans, and seeks to divide us up. By these measures, any objective observer will conclude that based on her ideas and her leadership, Hillary Clinton must become the next president of the United States.
And Claire, you can hear in that clip that at times Sanders having trouble finishing his thoughts. The response from the crowd is so loud. What was it like being there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, one thing I was watching for and a big question was the extent that people would boo, because I was also earlier in the day, Bernie Sanders met with all of his delegates. This was at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in downtown Philadelphia, and it was inside this ballroom, and that's when he said to them directly, we need to elect Hillary Clinton, and it was an ugly scene. There was just really loud boos, and he wasn't able to, he had to sort of pause and was kind of interrupted by how angry the crowd was. And so I was looking for the speech last night to see basically how intense the booing would be. And I will say it was less than I had seen earlier in the afternoon. But for example, you know, that moment, that clip that you played, there was, when he was saying we need a leader who doesn't divide, you know, the crowd was chanting Bernie, Bernie, Bernie. I mean, they're hearing those words and they're still thinking they want Bernie Sanders to be that leader for them. When he eventually got around to saying Clinton, there were a lot of cheers, you know, and I think the Hillary Clinton supporters, they know that the spotlight's on them and they're going to make a lot of noise for their candidate, too. But there's certainly a lot of boos as well.
Now, most of America who's watching is not, they're watching in the evening. They're not seeing what's happening during the day. Are you hearing or seeing anything during the day that isn't on primetime TV to indicate that Sanders is still at all entertaining any kind of a struggle with Clinton?
Well, I think that, You know, I think that Sanders, at least publicly, has made his peace. He's at this point, you know, he's told his delegates that he wants them to support Clinton. He made the case last night, and there was even reports that the Sanders campaign team was working together with the Clinton campaign team to try to make sure that there weren't any sort of protests on the floor. And Sanders, last night, before he took the stage, he sent a personal message to his delegates that said, please, I'm asking as a personal courtesy, not for there not to be any protests. But what I think is interesting that maybe hasn't been covered so much is that a lot of there are some delegates that, you know, if Sanders says don't protest, they're going to listen to him. But there's other delegates who sort of say, you know, look, we might be here for Sanders, but we're really here for the people that voted for him, and they're going to want us to fight against Clinton because that's why they voted us to be his delegates. And so even if he says no protests, we don't care. And I've talked to people who are Sanders delegates who say, we don't care if he says no protests. We still want to protest, and we're going to.
We're talking with Claire Foran right now, associate editor at The Atlantic. She's covering the Democratic National Convention, and she's joining us to talk about whether the Democratic Party will unify at the convention this week in Philadelphia. And Claire, it sounds as though what you heard last night, you said the boos were not quite as intense as you'd anticipated, and we've got day two of the convention unfolding today. So based on what you're seeing today, are you getting the sense that maybe sentiment is tapering among people who are still wanting to continue rallying to Bernie Sanders? Or do you think this is going to be an issue throughout the convention?
Well, so I think that when Bernie Sanders last night, when he sent out the message to delegates saying, please don't protest, I certainly do think that that probably took sort of the wind out of the sails for some delegates. And I was at a press conference this morning, and it was sort of this informal group of people who are their delegates themselves, and they're working to take the pulse of the rest of the Bernie delegates about whether or not there should be protests. And today they sort of said, you know, we don't know, we're not sure. And they wouldn't, basically they wouldn't commit to saying that there's going to be some disruption. And to me, that seemed like it wasn't that, you know, it sort of seemed like they're hesitant to kind of say, you know, we really want to be disruptive in light of the fact that Bernie said, you know, please don't protest. But that said, one thing to look for tonight is that tonight there's going to be the roll call vote. So this will be a chance where the delegates for each state will get to report, you know, how many delegates for each candidate came to their state. And this is a chance for the delegates to sort of step to the microphone and have their say. And it's possible that if there was some kind of disruption, it could happen during the roll call vote this evening.
Now, one notable Sanders supporter, comedian Sarah Silverman, talked last night at the convention with Minnesota Senator Al Franken. And here's what she had to say.
I will vote for Hillary with gusto. Continue to be inspired and moved to action by the ideals set forth by Bernie, who will never stop fighting for us. I am proud to be a part of Bernie's movement, and a vital part of that movement is making absolutely sure that Hillary Clinton is our next president of the United States.
Sarah Silverman there last night saying she was a Sanders supporter. Now she will vote for Hillary with gusto. And other Sanders supporters on the convention floor saying last night that she has to make us, she has to earn our vote. And I wonder what you're hearing there from people about what Hillary Clinton would have to do to earn that vote during this week. And this is not a long amount of time, only a couple more days. What has to happen?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I've been asking people that as well. I mean, one thing, you know, I think I've heard a lot more, you know, people can clearly sort of articulate what really bothers them about the way the convention has been run so far. The biggest complaint I've heard from Sanders supporters is that they feel like it's been run like the fight's already over. You know, they haven't actually formally announced the nominee, but every speaker that gets on stage says, you know, it's Hillary Clinton that's going to be our next president, and they feel very dismissed and frustrated by that. They also feel like the pick of Tim Kaine as Hillary Clinton's vice president, who is not as progressive as many of them would like, is kind of, I've heard people describe it as a slap in the face. So as far as what Clinton could do, I mean, I think that I think that, maybe some of it would be, so I've heard some Bernie Sanders say that they just wish that some of the speakers on stage would just merely spend more time talking about how successful and how important Bernie Sanders was to this race. A lot of them feel like they just want that recognition, and they feel like they've been sort of pushed aside and are being kind of taken for granted. So, maybe even just the way that the speakers at the convention are talking about the candidates might help to create some goodwill that doesn't exist right now.
And Claire, just very briefly, do you think that this sort of, I guess you could call it a little bit of a drama going on there, is distracting the focus from repositioning the Democratic target there toward Donald Trump?
I think one thing, too, to keep in mind is that when you look at the polls, a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters in the aggregate are shifting their support to Hillary Clinton. So I think that that's not necessarily going to be reflected in all of the delegates, because the delegates, of course, are people who are sort of, by their very nature of wanting to become delegates, going through that process, are going to tend to be the more activist, the more vocal. But I think that in general terms, even if there are protests or sort of expressions of disunity at the convention, that's meaningful, but it certainly doesn't speak for all Bernie Sanders supporters. And yes, I think yesterday there was certainly a lot of focus on the threat of a Donald Trump presidency. And I will say that even speaking to delegates, I've not talked to any delegates so far that think that Donald Trump would be an acceptable choice. And there are certainly Sanders supporters who say, when it comes down to it, I'll vote for Clinton rather than see Donald Trump win.
Claire, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Claire Foran, associate editor at The Atlantic, where she's been covering the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, joining us there to talk about whether the Democratic Party will unify at this convention this week in Philadelphia.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll talk to Democratic Congressional Representative Gwen Moore about her contested primary next month.
Right now, we're talking about Wisconsin and international trade. The Trans-Pacific Partnership has been mentioned more than a few times during the race for president. According to our next guest, any new international trade policy could have a sizable impact on Wisconsin's economy.
Agriculture, manufacturing, and a growing technology sector are major Wisconsin industries and are part of the global marketplace. As of 2015, Wisconsin's export value came out to about $22.4 billion. More than a quarter of those exports were industrial machinery.
Our next guest wrote about Wisconsin's ties to the world economy for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom Still joins us now. He's president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you, Rob.
Well, we gave one statistic there, but can you give us a sense of how much of Wisconsin's economy participates in international trade?
It is a growing share, without a doubt. I mean, when you look at manufacturing, ag, and increasingly tech, more and more companies are a part of this. If you look at percentage terms, it's somewhere probably in terms of gross product. It's somewhere above 10% of the Wisconsin economy is pretty much directly tied up in some kind of trade. So it's a significant share and rising.
I don't think of Wisconsin. I think a lot of people don't think of Wisconsin as having a big export sector. But why do we? Why is that 10% of our economy here in the state?
We make and grow things. They get right down to it, and we make and grow things that people want. If you look at, the profile of manufacturing, it's a lot of equipment that really is made best here and can be exported to other countries in need of such equipment. And the same thing goes for ag in terms of our overall product base there. If you look at our trade partners, sort of the top trade partners, you get a sense of the needs that they may have. Canada is by far and away the biggest trade partner, about $7.3 billion. And Mexico is number two, a strong number two at almost $3 billion a year. Then China, United Kingdom, Japan, Germany, Saudi Arabia, Australia are all in line after that. They're places that in some cases, have a rising middle class. In other cases, they are countries that are accustomed to having quality goods, quality services, and quality agricultural products. You know, in a state that produces everything from lumber to paper products to plastics to electrical machinery, it's really a strong mix. So I think our diverse economy helps a lot.
Do trade agreements, things like NAFTA in the past and this Trans-Pacific Partnership that's in the works and a subject of controversy now, do you see them helping Wisconsin businesses, producers export goods?
I think on balance they help. And let's take a look just at NAFTA, which was really the original signatories are Canada, Mexico, and the United States. Well, Canada and Mexico are our number one and number two trade partners. The Trans-Pacific Agreement would involve a number of countries in the Pacific Rim, 11 others, counting in addition to the United States, and that's where there's also room for growth: Japan, Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, Thailand. Those are all countries that. That have, in most cases, a rising middle class and a demand for our goods.
Talking to Tom Still from the Wisconsin Technology Council about Wisconsin's economy and the global market and how free trade agreements fit in, a big subject in the presidential race. And Tom, a lot of people listening will probably hear you say, okay, yes, we benefit in those ways, but we worry that manufacturing jobs in particular have been outsourced. They've been sent overseas to other countries or across borders to Mexico. We've lost a lot of jobs here in Wisconsin, good-paying jobs. On balance, the argument, we've done worse rather than better because of agreements like this.
Yeah, I would say you need to take a look at what jobs had been outsourced. In some cases, they're not the kinds of manufacturing jobs that Wisconsin is well positioned to keep. They may be jobs that are in industries that perhaps the competition from abroad was already so significant. They were also in some cases not the sort of in a tech-based manufacturing job or a tech-based agricultural job that is even going to provide more value. So while some jobs were lost early on, I think that's beginning to change. We are seeing that we actually have the opposite going on right now with foreign direct investment in Wisconsin. And at this point, there's something like 1,500 companies in Wisconsin that have some kind of foreign investment, which is keeping jobs here. Which is often modernizing plants, which is providing new supply chains, new markets, and opening doors in that way. So that's why I say, on balance, this has been a good thing for Wisconsin because it's helped modernize a lot of industries that are truly global in nature.
Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders both did better, I think, than anyone expected at the outset of their campaigns, in part by attacking free trade agreements and appealing to people who I think who have been on the wrong side of that balance. If you look at a community, say, where the paper mill is shut down because of foreign competition, there are pockets, aren't there, at least, where they've done more harm than good, these free trade agreements.
Well, let's take the paper industry. Were paper mills in Wisconsin shut down because of foreign competition or because they were shut down with massive changes in society's need for paper? Was it shut down because of the birth of the Internet? I mean, there's a lot of factors that can play into that. Wisconsin used to be a leading paper-making state, and it still is, but that entire industry contracted, what it has to do with foreign competition is somewhat questionable. It's really more about changes within that industry itself.
Donald Trump has made the case, not so much that free trade agreements in and of themselves are bad. He says they've been negotiated poorly, that they've been to the disadvantage of the United States. Do you think there's room to get out there and negotiate on terms that would help the U.S. more? And is it a zero-sum game if we gain, do our partners lose?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think there's always room for those kinds of improvements in negotiations because it really is about the details. And, Hillary Clinton has said that when she initially backed the Trans-Pacific Partnership but then thought twice about it because she would really like to see some renegotiation from everything I have read and seen. So it is really about getting the details right and making sure that there are protections from everything from job loss, but also to having tariffs not hurt on the other side of the equation, to environmental protections, and just a variety of things that do matter at the end of the day.
Tom, you work with policymakers, business people. What would be your advice for people who are working here in Wisconsin to boost the economy? How can we best take advantage of the international market right now to create jobs here in the state?
Well, I think there are a number of really good portals that are available for companies that may not have really thought about how they can take advantage of what's going on. Through the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, for example, their international division has a variety of programs that help companies learn how to better take advantage of what's out there and to get more quickly into markets and to avoid some of the red tape, avoid some cultural issues, get around some of the language barriers. When you look at the United States, and we're about, 5% of the world's population, the other 95% is where we're going to have to sell a lot of our goods and services and products. And so I think companies here need to think more globally about where they go. After I wrote the piece with the Journal Sentinel, I heard from a company in West Bend that I had no idea would have as much of a global footprint as they did, but they said, yeah, fully 10% of their jobs are tied up in exports.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely, Rob.
That's Tom Still. He's president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. He talked to us about how trade policy will affect us here in Wisconsin and our local economy.
Coming up after the news, we continue our series of candidate interviews leading up to next month's congressional primary. Today, Democratic Representative Gwen Moore joins us. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, should we trust our gut when trying to figure out what other people are thinking and feeling? A psychologist shares some of the latest research.
First, primary elections are next month on Tuesday, August 9th. We've invited the congressional candidates in all contested primaries to join us on Central Time and on the Joy Cardine Show.
Yesterday at this time, we heard from Gary George, the challenger in the Democratic primary for Wisconsin's 4th congressional district in the Milwaukee area. Today, Gwen Moore joins us. She's the incumbent in that race.
The winner will face an independent and a libertarian candidate in November. There are no Republicans on the ballot in the race.
Representative Moore joined us earlier today. She is participating in events at the Democratic National Convention this afternoon. Representative Moore, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
So I want to start by having you make your case to voters that they should elect you for another term. What would you say?
Well, I believe that I've been a great steward for the constituents of the 4th Congressional District, not only in Washington, D.C., but at home. In the good old days, when I first arrived in Congress 12 years ago, we had earmarks consistent with the First Amendment of the Constitution, but I think... right now, earmarks are not allowed. And so I've had to be very, very creative with trying to bring resources back to my community. But what that has done is to ensure that I have met down with every single mayor of the municipalities surrounding Milwaukee and, of course, including Milwaukee, to try to find out what their highest priorities are. I have written letters of support for grants that are potentially available to our communities for various projects. Brought in about $80 million in the last cycle with regard to that. Really worked very closely with the mayor of the city of Milwaukee, to make sure that Milwaukee got the designation, really proud of that, as a manufacturing hub, which entitles us to be first in line for all of the agencies in the federal government, be at the front of the line, Department of Commerce, HUD, et cetera, to receive grants programs. I've worked very, very diligently in my position on the Financial Services Committee to really be one of the chief architects of an initiative to despite the obstruction from Republicans, to free the Export-Import Bank from a partisan deadlock. That's so important to my community, given the machine and metal working industry that we're so reliant upon. And I've been a great steward over Lake Michigan, belong to the Great Lakes caucus, and that's a bipartisan caucus that's working diligently on Great Lakes issues. And so I've been very, very, very active. I have so enjoyed engaging my diverse district. I got the most diverse district in the community. And so, you know, whether it's getting resources for the Burnham Street Canal on the south side or having the General Services Administration come in to do work with demonstrating what federal resources are available to our police departments, to our city councils, I've just kind of been there. And so I would hope that this would be compelling to the constituents of our district.
And we spoke with your challenger, your primary challenger, Gary George, yesterday, and he says that you've talked a lot about the big issues facing your district, but that you haven't delivered what he said were real results. How do you respond to that?
Well, okay. Well, Gary George said that that I talk a lot, but I haven't delivered a lot. Well, for one thing, I just want to be real clear. I'm sure he talked about his glorified past as the chairman of the Finance Committee and being in the majority where he really had control over the state budget. And so there are many initiatives that other people accomplished, and because he was the chairman of that committee, he was able to take a great deal of credit for that. And I don't want to take any credit from Senator George for what he has done. But I think it's very Pollyanna for him to think that he's going to march into Congress, no relationships, no status, not being in the majority, and being able to do even 0.1% of what I've done. I've been able to develop relationships across the aisle. I have delivered. When I think, you can ask the Native American community, whether or not I've delivered. You know, I got the Violence Against Women Act reauthorized under great obstruction. And again, I got the Export-Import Bank reauthorized with a procedure that hadn't been done in like 30 years on a bipartisan basis. I brought, in the absence of those kind of resources, we need jobs desperately. I was able to convince folks out of Minneapolis who are the Northwest, the Northeast Minority Business Supplier Development Council to come in with Boeing to our district and to do an in-service with all of our minority contractors in the area at absolutely right on the spot. A young woman who had a business was able to get a contract with Boeing and to establish those relationships. So I've had to work harder than Senator George worked when he was the chairman of the Finance Committee. And it was, I remember him bragging about, for example, building the DNR building on 3rd and Center. That was an initiative of former Senator John Norquist. or bragging about creating the school choice program. You might remember, for better or for worse, whether you agree with that, that was a great initiative of the late Annette Polly Williams. But he takes credit for it because Polly Williams' bill technically did not pass. Instead, he put it in the budget for her. And so now I think it's just sad that he won't even allow this deceased woman to claim her, the legacy of her career. I have a record that people can check. I've done more than just talk. I've delivered. I'm in the minority. So often they're not bills that have been passed, but they're initiatives that have been tucked in other bills. Other Republicans take credit for your bill when you're in the minority. But I've done things, everything from economic development to stopping human trafficking to quality of life issues that affect our community. I've been on the budget committee almost since the day I arrived.
I want to zero in on one thing we talked a bit about yesterday, one of the issues facing Milwaukee, issues related to crime and violence. Now, your challenger, Gary George, he wants an amped up presence, a stronger presence of law enforcement in the areas. He's talking about a plan that would include U.S. Marshals, FBI agents, and he says the National Guard if necessary. How would you tackle those same issues?
Well, okay, first of all, Senator George's notion that, I think that he is lobbying on to probably some polling that has been done by Republicans who I believe are supporting him, that or Donald Trump, that you can sort of gin people up with the whole crime thing, whether that is whether that's true or not. Our district attorney came in and showed charts, really actual facts, that crime has gone down in our area. Actual facts, not rhetoric, not ginning people up. And in terms of law enforcement, I've been very happy to work with law enforcement on things that I think that are relevant to our community, not just some ginned up, made up, create hysteria so that people will vote for me. The FBI built a brand new facility in our district, and they were looking around to move it. And you can ask them if you'd like that. I mean, I sat on them and made sure that they relocated it in the 4th Congressional District. So that asset and that resource is there. I've also introduced a bill, for example, which, according to the ACLU, who chided us and chastised Congress for adjourning without doing anything on guns, they said that I had introduced a must-pass bill, one of six must-pass bills, and that was the bill that really would sort of try to sow some reconciliation between the community and our police department. And that is a bill to tie the receipt of burned JAG funds to de-escalation training for police officers. Now, this de-escalation training is one of 34 recommendations that came out of the Police Executive Research Forum. It's a peer group of police executives that are based on solid research. And in fact, the de-escalation training is something that was employed in Dallas, where crime went down and negative encounters with the police went down. That was one of the things that was so unfortunate about the Dallas incident. And you heard many of the protesters laud the Dallas police force for how responsible they've been under this de-escalation training model. And so that's one of the things that I'm working on very, very diligently. You know, I have been very, very vocal against great opposition from Republicans to try to promote gun safety in our district. I, in fact, did a huge expose on Badger guns. Educated people about the fact that not only was Badger guns, which unfortunately is in my district, but exposed the fact that not only was it like in the top 1% of all the gun stores in the country that sold crime guns, but it was a store that sold guns where cops were shot. And to try to introduce legislation, of course, Republicans won't take that up, to give the AFT more powers to shut down these crime gun shops, these gun shops like Badger Guns that sell these crime guns. I've worked very, very diligently to get guns out of the hands of people who have been arrested, have restraining orders for domestic violence. I'm taking on the issue of crime, where crime actually exists, and not some hyped up something for electioneering purposes.
And Representative,
I'm really proud of my record.
Representative Moore, sorry to interrupt. We've got about a minute left. I want to ask you before we let you go. You've supported Hillary Clinton in the presidential primary. Your opponent says he supported Bernie Sanders. Where do you think the party stands now with its prospects for unity going forward?
Well, you know, 90% of the Bernie supporters have said that they would support Hillary Clinton. Obviously, we got a great deal of work to do. Bernie Sanders, I think, really has brought it had an excellent campaign. Reflection of that is the platform committee that we platform that the Democrats have voted on and ratified last night. Just the most progressive platform ever. And I support so many notions that Bernie talked about. You know, this notion that there was this huge distance and light between Hillary Clinton and Bernie, it's just not the case. When you're running against somebody, you have to try to draw these distinctions. And Bernie did a great deal, I think, in terms of moving Mrs. Clinton to the left. But as anybody will tell you, I am a progressive. I would have been just as happy to support Senator Sanders had he prevailed. But as a Democrat, I'm going to be working really hard to elect Hillary Clinton to be the next president of the United States.
Representative Moore, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you, Veronica.
That was Gwen Moore, Democratic congressional representative in Wisconsin's 4th District. Yesterday, we talked with her primary challenger, Gary George. Primary elections take place on Tuesday, August 9th. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get the latest on the Democratic National Convention from our Capitol Bureau Chief, Sean Johnson. He's in Philadelphia this week.
First, a lot of us sort ourselves into two categories, people who go with our gut and people who rely on reason and logic. Both are useful, but is one better than the other for reading people and their feelings? New research tries to answer that question.
Regan Gurung joins us now to discuss empathy, thought, and instinct. He's the Ben Jay and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Human Development and Psychology at UW-Green Bay. He joins us from our WPR studios there. Regan, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
Well, what do we mean when we say empathy, when we're looking at it from a psychological perspective?
So from a nice basic level, when we talk about empathy, we're talking about, do I know how you're feeling? And I think what's fascinating is there are many of us who believe we are very empathetic. Oh, I'm so empathetic. But the interesting thing is, are we accurately empathetic or not? So you may think you're empathetic. You may think you can read somebody else's feelings, but you may not always be right. And that's what this new study does. Actually, it's a new paper with 4 studies that really nicely unpacks what exactly makes or predicts empathic accuracy.
Right. And part of what they did in these studies is try to tease out, do we do better when we just use our gut instinct versus when we think it through? I guess we observe a person and try to weigh what they're feeling, why that could be. What did they learn?
So the short answer is your intuition, as useful as it is in so many different situations, may not be the most useful tool we have for empathic accuracy. And I think that's a really key thing to hear where you go, wow, but I'm so intuitive, it may not be the best way. What's the key is systematic and deliberate thinking. And that's what they did here. And what's neat about this set of studies is they go beyond just correlation, where they just look at associations between factors, but they also manipulate how a person thinks. So there was one of my favorite studies in the series is the last study where they actually made people play up their intuitive thinking, and they made another group of people play up their systematic, deliberate thinking. And lo and behold, when it came down to measuring empathic accuracy, those individuals who were thinking in a deliberate, systematic fashion were more empathically accurate.
So we can see the value of empathy just on a human level, trying to understand how people are feeling and maybe behaving accordingly to them. Also on a professional level, I suppose managers might want some empathy to figure out what their staff are doing. So is one of the takeaways here that we can train ourselves, we can become smarter and better when it comes to empathy?
I think here's where it gets a little tricky, because the new research basically shows, yes, deliberate systematic thinking is important, but how exactly do you do it? What exactly should you be doing? And one of the takeaway messages is a reminder that very often we are driven by our stereotypes. We may have prejudices that are operating in a non-conscious way. And sometimes when we try to judge somebody, sometimes when we try to say, ooh, what are they feeling, without knowing it, we are actually relying on those stereotypes, relying on those prejudices. So that's where that intuition or gut feeling comes in. It feels like a gut feeling, but psychologically speaking, it's really a very automatic process. So I like thinking about gut and intuition as it's this automatic process. It's come from years of experience. It's come from many things that we've learned or done before. And when it comes time to make a decision, we make it automatically and quickly. Now, sometimes that can help. And there are definitely some situations where it's fine. But for the most part, the more deliberative, systematic thinking we can take part in, it's better. So the take home here is we have stereotypes. We have prejudices. Something that makes us less reliant or misled by those is slowing down and thinking systematically.
Well, wow, that leads to a big picture on empathy and other things, too. How can we be aware of our gut sort of instinct decisions? And when we need to question them, when we need to not go with that and think more deeply, how can we ingrain that self-questioning habit into our daily lives?
Well, and I think the bad news is, when do we need to think about it? Pretty much all the time. There are some
that sounds exhausting.
It does. And, you know, that's why psychologists and psychological science refers to human beings as cognitive misers very often. We take the shortcuts. And the great news is, most of the time, those shortcuts serve us very well. What I like to think about is, watch out for the times that you are tired. Watch out for the times that you are stressed. Because when we are tired and stressed, that's when that systematic thinking goes by the wayside, and we're more likely to rely on knee-jerk reactions, which can often get us into trouble and hurt the feelings of others.
All right. And getting back to that empathy research, there's hope there. It sounds like you're saying that we can become more empathic, even if we feel we just weren't born that way.
Oh, absolutely. I think, as I said, even intuition is based on experience. What systematic, deliberate thinking is doing is actually paying more attention to specific items. For example, there's a range of studies that show when we can see somebody's eyes, we are more likely to be, our empathic accuracy goes up. So if I'm talking to somebody and I'm looking at their face, specifically the area around their eyes, I have a higher likelihood of being more empathically accurate. And again, that accurate is so key. You know, don't fool yourselves into thinking that you're empathic. Always go a step further and, you know, check with the person you're trying to read. Now, in the business situation, I think it's a great skill to have empathic accuracy, because you know what your customer wants, you know what your client wants. It's superb for negotiations. Another favorite of mine is in Armenia, where they actually have kids playing chess and watching the other players and their moves. They read emotions and they practice reading emotions and almost predicting the kind of chess moves that are going to be coming up. So I think that's it. Pay attention to your surroundings. Go beyond those automatic thoughts that pop into your head. Sometimes it's fine, but the more you can do to go beyond those, the better off you are.
Regan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot.
That's Regan Gurung. He's a professor of human development and psychology at UW Green Bay. By the way, you can read his blog post on some of the research we've been talking about it. We have a link for it up at the Central Time Facebook page, and let us know if you think you're particularly empathetic.
Pokemon Go continues to sweep the world, and it's been released in its country of origin, Japan. There's been a lot of fun, but also warnings about staying safe while trying to catch them all.
And it's inspired a lot of humor, including a new quiz online at Slate.com, the quiz titled Pokemon or Cholesterol Medication. Veronica, do you want to give it a try?
I totally want to give it a try.
All right, so the premise here, pretty straightforward. There's a name. Is it a Pokemon or a cholesterol medication?
Check.
Ready?
Ready.
Crestor. Pokemon or cholesterol med?
I feel like that's a cholesterol medication.
It is. That one's too easy. That's pretty clear. Okay. Lapras.
Also a cholesterol Pokemon?
Well, wait. You demonstrated empathy by looking at the shocked reaction in my eyes. Yep. That is a Pokemon.
Okay.
Nidoran. Nidoran.
Nidoran. I'm going to say that that is a cholesterol medication, Rob.
It is a small rat-like, not cholesterol med, but Pokemon.
Dang it.
Let's do. I've got a couple more here. Vitarin.
Vitarin. A Pokemon of small furry provenance.
You have children, right?
I know.
Where but you don't take a lot of cholesterol. That's a cholesterol medication.
Are you making these Pokemon up?
Vulpix. Last one. Vulpix.
A cholesterol med.
Wow.
No?
Wow.
I can't hold my head up when I go home.
Okay. Well, hopefully they're not listening.
Terrible.
Keep you up to date on all the latest pharmaceuticals and Pokemon news. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.